This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, actor Sean Hayes, will host the Tony Awards Sunday, where he's also nominated for Best Lead Actor in a Musical. In the hit NBC sitcom Will and Grace, Hayes played Jack, the very extroverted gay friend. Today, Sean Hayes is starring opposite Kristen Chenoweth in the Broadway revival of the 1968 musical Promises, Promises. Adapted from the movie The Apartment, the show features songs by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. We'll hear from them later in the show. In Promises, Promises, Sean Hayes plays Chuck Baxter, an employee at an insurance company stuck in a low-level job. He has something his boss wants, an apartment in Manhattan, an apartment the boss can use to carry on an affair. So Baxter gives a key to his boss in return for the promise of a promotion. Terry spoke to Sean Hayes about the show in April. Let's start with Sean Hayes singing Promises, Promises, the title song.
Promises, promises, I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. If I shout, remember, I feel free. Now I can look at myself and be proud. I'm laughing out loud.
Sean Hayes, welcome to Fresh Air. I really enjoyed your performance in Promises, Promises.
Well, thank you.
Now, I know you performed in the Encores production of Damn Yankees, but that wasn't officially Broadway. This is your official Broadway debut. So, you know, I've heard you sing comedically as Jack in Will and Grace, but here you're singing for real and singing well for real. Did you sing much before this?
No, actually, I think that's one of the reasons I did this, as well as 50 other reasons, most of which shall remain in my head. But one of the reasons was to challenge myself and see if I could really conquer this kind of thing that I've always been toying with, the singing thing. And I don't, by any means, don't pretend to be a singer or label myself a singer. I'm definitely an actor first, but it's fun to kind of, you know, push your boundaries and see if you can do things that have scared you a little bit your whole life.
So if singing scares you a little bit and you're out on a Broadway stage singing, that's got to be scary with a capital S.
Yeah, that's what life's about, though, isn't it? Isn't it about getting out of your comfort zone and getting off the couch and challenging yourself and forcing yourself to do things you wouldn't otherwise do? Otherwise, what are you living for?
Comfort. I'm living for comfort.
Well, actually, I'm realizing that now. Comfort never sounded so great.
Now, at the end of Promises, Promises, there's a very high note you have to reach.
Mm-hmm.
Is that easy for you, or do you get a little worried each night?
Yeah, no, I do. Anytime, because it's just you. You're bare out on stage, alone in front of the audience. Just you, and you feel like everybody's judging you, which is, of course, that's what we do. As an actor, we're judged the second we walk on a stage. So, but I've never been, and I'm okay being judged as an actor. It's new for me to be judged as a singer. So there's a little added pressure that I put on myself and a little added fear that I put on myself. So that's what I've had to overcome.
Did you know some of the more famous songs from the show, like Promises, Promises, I'll Never Fall in Love Again, Knowing When to Leave, and two other Bacharach David songs were added to this production, I Say a Little Prayer and A House Is Not a Home. How familiar were you with those songs?
Well, I knew Promises and I knew Never Fall in Love Again only from the radio from being a kid. and of course, The House Is Not a Home and Say a Little Prayer. I was unfamiliar with the rest, and to be quite honest, the very, very first listen to those songs for me was the original cast recording. And a lot of them you don't walk away humming, but if you listen to it even a second time, let alone 100 times like I have, they really do grow on you, and you kind of gain a certain affection for them, and you realize why the show was a hit back in the 60s. You know, there's a couple songs that you don't, you know, go to the urinal during intermission and hum, but they really do stick with you.
Now, you do have a music background. You studied music. You studied piano. You studied conducting, I think.
You played in college.
In college, you played a lot of Mozart. Mm-hmm. Why classical music?
I think that's just what came more natural to me. As a kid, that's what I started on. And, you know, we're talking about comfort zones earlier. I think that's where my comfort zone was.
So why did you change from music to acting?
I think that was probably always my destiny. And I fought it because I grew up in a family of many brothers that won accolades for their sporting events and everything. And so I thought I was a little embarrassed to pursue acting at such a young age. And I thought it wasn't the macho thing to do, I'm being completely honest. And so so I always kind of had this passion for it. I would always hang out in the theater as much as I could, because those people made me laugh the most. I mean, I used to watch Saturday Night Live as a kid constantly and go, God, they look like they're having so much fun. Why am I not doing that? And so I think when I got to college, as do a lot of people, you discover who you are and find yourself more than you did before. You go, yeah, this feels right. This feels right to be amongst funny people and people who enjoy what they do. So I kind of pursued both at the same time. I was pursuing music during the day, and at night I would go hang out with all the theater folks, watch shows, and do improvisational groups and things like that. So I was on a two-way track.
Now, once you decided to act, your first real role was in a film called Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss. This is an indie film with a lot of unknown people in it. Did you have any confidence that it would be good?
No. I at the time I wasn't working. I just moved to Los Angeles, and because if you wanted to do TV or film, that's where you need to be. And I literally just auditioned and got the job like 2 days later. And my agent was like, "Do you want to do this or not? It's no money. It's nothing." And I was like, "I'm not doing anything else." So I did it, and then from that got Will and Grace.
Our guest is Sean Hayes, who's currently starring in the Broadway revival of the musical Promises, Promises. A few weeks before the show opened, Sean Hayes publicly came out as gay in an interview with The Advocate. After the show opened, in the May 10th issue of Newsweek, a controversial essay by Ramin Sotouda questioned whether gay actors like Hayes could convincingly play straight characters. Sotouda wrote, "It's weird seeing Hayes play straight. He comes off as wooden and insincere, like he's trying to hide something, which, of course, he is. While it's okay for straight actors to play gay, it's rare for someone to pull off the trick in reverse," unquote. Sean Hayes' co-star, Kristen Chenoweth, described the Newsweek essay as horrendously homophobic, a sentiment shared by many angry readers. Sean Hayes has said little about the article, though he called it asinine on the TV program The View. Before the magazine hit the stands, during the Promises, Promises opening week, Terry Gross asked Sean Hayes about coming out and about playing the character Jack on the NBC sitcom Will and Grace.
One of the things about your character Jack is that he always wanted to have, you know, like a one-man show in which he'd sing, do a little dancing. And mm-hmm. now that you've made your Broadway singing debut, I thought it would be fun to listen back to Jack singing. And he had this ambition to do, you know, the show Jack 2000 and Jack 2001. So here's a scene in which he's trying to cheer Grace, who's sick and in bed. He's trying to cheer her up by singing.
Anyway, I find that the one thing that really makes people smile is my music. or my oddly long tongue. Your choice.
Music.
Good. Because I finally figured out how to make Jack 2001 different than Jack 2000.
You're gonna get an audience?
No. I'm gonna sing a medley of songs with the word one in them. Yeah. So let the healing begin. Hit it! You're still the one I wanna talk to in bed. Hey, still the one that turns my head. You're still having fun, and you're still the one. Singular sensation, every little step she takes. Ski-ba-la-ski-ba-la-ski. One. Thrilling combination, every move that she makes. One less bell to answer. One less egg to fry. One less man to pick up after. I should be happy, but all I do is cry. Oh, Grace, you're crying. Oh, is it because of my song? I can't believe I made you cry. Okay, it's great! I did it! I finally moved someone to tears with my art!
Sean Hayes in a scene from Will and Grace. How is your character of Jack described in that first script, the one that you used to audition?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember. But to me, you know, at the beginning of Will and Grace, I played Jack as the funny next-door neighbor type, as we've seen in the past. And I thought that was my role. I didn't really play into the gay part as much, the stereotypical gay part. And I have to say, the critics, for not being that educated about the gay lifestyle, I think pegged Jack as the flamboyant, extremely gay character. So, because they didn't know what else to call him. Because if Will is seemingly straight acting, oh, then Jack must be very feminine and very flamboyant. Whereas I wasn't playing him as feminine, because I know a lot of gay guys who are extremely feminine, kind of like Carson Kressley type from the, what was that, the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Those snapping kind of girly, that to me was stereotypical gay, the very feminine gay guy. But if you didn't label Jack as gay, and he would have just been the funny next door neighbor who had a lot of energy the way Jim Carrey, Robin Williams, Marty Short, any of these guys did.
So so you changed your interpretation of the character as time went on?
Mm-hmm, definitely, 100%. Because I wanted to explore the... I wanted more distance between the two types of gay characters, between Jack and Will. If you look at the first season, Jack's not – there's the mannerisms and the – a lot of the dialogue is more towards the stereotypical flamboyant gay guy. But a lot of the mannerisms aren't. And then as time went on, I added more and more and more and more.
Now, you've used the word stereotypical. Were you afraid that at some point you would be playing into a stereotype?
At that point, I didn't really care. I knew what was funny and what was true to that character, the growth of Jack, to that character. And so what was true to the growth of that character was to play him that way. That was so well written, you know, so well written.
Right before Promises, Promises opened, you did an interview with The Advocate in which you acknowledged you were gay, whereas previously you declined to talk about that, saying that the less people knew about your personal life, the more open-minded they could be about each role that you played. And I was wondering, like, why now?
So we wouldn't have to talk about it?
And so here am I talking about it.
Right.
Is that your point?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So can I just ask you...
Because it's, you know, it's just, there's nothing relevant about someone's sexuality to what they do for a living.
But what's relevant to me is that your first big roles, both in Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss and in Will and Grace, were as gay characters. And mm-hmm. I think probably for a lot of young gay people in particular, it's great to have gay characters on screen because not until recently were there any.
Billy Crystal in the 70s on soap. I mean, there's tons of examples. But I think any positive that has come out from me playing gay characters in TV or film is amazing and a wonderful byproduct of you know what I've done. And if it's helped anybody, then my life is complete because that's a wonderful thing.
Well, one of the things that you did was a made-for-TV movie about Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. You played Jerry Lewis. Jeremy Northam played Dean Martin. And what did you most pick up on watching hours and hours and hours of Jerry Lewis?
What did I most pick up on? Very similar kind of sense of what I went through on as playing Jack in Will and Grace, which was how different the man was offstage than he was playing, as he called, the idiot. Jerry Lewis referred, I don't know if a lot of people know this, Jerry Lewis referred to his on-camera persona, whether in movies or TV, as the idiot. And so the idiot couldn't be further from who Jerry Lewis was. And I kind of can completely relate to that, whereas people recognize me as the idiot Jack. But I don't see myself as that. I know others do, but I don't. But that's what I picked up most upon.
So why don't we hear a scene with you as Jerry Lewis from the Jerry Lewis movie that was made for TV. And in this scene, Dean Martin, played by Jeremy Northam, is doing his act at a club, and you kind of crash the act. You come in dressed as a waiter and with a tower of dishes on your arm that you keep dropping, and they come crashing to the floor as Dean Martin is doing his act. So here's the scene.
And when I look up at the stars and ask them all what's new, they join me in the answer, darling, it's you, my own.
Excuse me, pardon me, I'm coming through, excuse me, pardon me, I'm sorry.
My own.
Hold there.
I hope we're good going.
I'm very sorry, kind sir. I didn't mean to interrupt anything.
No. I was getting kind of tired of that song anyway.
So was the audience, but I didn't want to say nothing.
Oh, wise guy.
Go ahead, Mr. Singer. Make like I'm not even here. I'm not here.
I wish you'd make like you weren't even here.
That's a scene with Sean Hayes as Jerry Lewis and Jeremy Northam as Dean Martin. So
that brings back great memories.
Does it?
Yeah, it was really fun to do that.
You know, I was wondering if maybe you didn't draw on what you learned from that just a little bit for your role in Promises, Promises.
Just playing Jerry Lewis?
Just a little bit of Jerry Lewis in there, yeah.
Yeah, people have said that. I wasn't conscious, but if you picked up on that, maybe it was subconscious. But that's actually, I love that scene. That's a really funny story, true story about how they began working together. Jerry saw that Dean wasn't doing too well with the audience at that time and wanted to kind of amp it up a bit and get the audience going. So he came in with plates and just started dropping. I mean, the guy was fearless. I love that. And that's how that relationship started. It was a beautiful thing.
Well, Sean Hayes, thanks so much for talking with us, and good luck with Promises, Promises.
Thank you so much.
Sean Hayes speaking with Terry Gross. He's nominated for a Tony Award for his performance in the Broadway revival of Promises, Promises, and he's hosting the Tony Award Sunday night. We'll hear from Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who wrote the music for Promises, Promises, in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Tony Awards are this Sunday, and four nominations have gone to the revival of Promises, Promises, featuring songs by our next guests, Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Bacharach and David are one of the greatest songwriting teams of the second half of the 20th century. Among their songs are Make It Easy on Yourself, Only Love Can Break a Heart, Don't Make Me Over, Anyone Who Had a Heart, Wishin' and Hopin', There's Always Something There to Remind Me, What the World Needs Now is Love, and The Look of Love. Dionne Warwick recorded 38 singles written by Bacharach and David that made the charts. Promises, Promises is the only Broadway musical they've done. Two songs from the original 1968 production became hits, the title song and I Say a Little Prayer. Neil Simon wrote the book for the show, adapting it from the Billy Wilder movie The Apartment. The revival stars Sean Hayes and Kristen Chenoweth. Terry spoke to Burt Bacharach and Hal David in April when the show opened.
Burt Bacharach, Hal David, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, it's such an honor to talk with you together. I was always hoping for a chance this would happen, and I'm grateful that that it has. Let's talk about some of the songs you wrote for the show. Let's start with the title song, Promises, Promises, which Jerry Orbach sang in the original production. So let's start by hearing his performance of Promises, Promises. So here we go.
Promises, promises, I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. If I shout, remember, I feel free. Now I can look at myself and be proud. I'm laughing out loud. Oh, promises, promises, this is where those promises, promises end. I won't pretend that what was wrong can be right. Every night I'll sleep now, no more lies. Things that I promised myself fell apart, but I found my heart. Oh, promises, they're kind of promises, take all the joy from life. Oh, promises, those kind of promises can just destroy your life. Oh, promises, promises, my kind of promises.
That's Jerry Orbach in the original cast recording of Promises, Promises. Burt Bacharach, Hal David, let's talk about how you wrote the song. Let's start with the title. Hal David, did the title Promises, Promises start with the song or with the show?
I think it started with David Merrick, who wanted a title song for the show.
And was the show already called Promises, Promises?
Yeah, and I think Neil wanted to call it Promises, Promises.
Yeah.
And not The Apartment. That was the source from the original film, the Billy Wilder film. And it was just kind of nice to hear Jerry Orbach singing there.
Yeah.
Because I guess I hadn't heard that cast album in...
In 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, Hal. I don't sit around listening to...
No, I don't either.
...our old cast album. But Jerry Orbach, he was wonderful in the show. I mean, as Sean Hayes is just... magnificent in the show. But I remember with Jerry Orbach coming into New York, when I came into New York, and would come to see the show maybe after it'd been playing 3 months, and I'd go backstage and see the cast, and Jerry Orbach would say to me, man, if I had to sing this song again, one more, yeah, because it's granted, it is a very notey, in other words, it's not an easy song to sing. My motivation was the urgency that makes it work dramatically, or you think it's going to work dramatically, by the anger that comes through. And it needed that many notes and that many words. But Jerry, after 3 months, was saying, why do you have to make it so difficult? Night after night, he's up there doing Promises, bro.
So, Burt Bacharach, you said it's so notey because it has to show anger. Well, the instruments, the orchestra is kind of like churning behind behind the singer. And it's just like there's such a kind of hyperactive energy going on there. And this, the time signature keeps changing. It changes like 20 right. times during the song. So it's just kind of like frenetic sounding and disorienting in a way. It's wonderful. Did you consciously say when you sat down to write the song, it needs 20 different key changes, signature changes?
No, I never do. I've never done anything like intentionally. It's only when I have gotten it where I'm hearing it, where it's in my head, where I can play it, where I can get away from it, lie on the couch, go over my head, and I start to write it down. And when I write it out, I realize, hey, that's changed. You've got to change time signature in this bar, time signature in this bar. So it's not deliberate. I mean, that's the main thing. It can drive musicians crazy, you know, until they stop counting and just hear and feel the music. I think it's kind of selfish on my part. I just write it, say, we got to get it done. You know, it'll get done. So as far as your observation about the churning and the orchestra, yeah. So much of what I've written, whether it's from the show or whenever, it's always been, it's almost like they come out of the same bed, you know? It's not just piano and voice. It's like where the drums will be playing, where the strings come in, where they are. Yeah. They are made and created about the same time as the song is being written.
So you hear that all in your head as you're writing the song. You hear the percussion, you hear the trumpet.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Well, that leads me to the final version I want to play of Promises, Promises, and that's the one that was the really big hit, Dionne Warwick's version. Did you know at the start that you would ask her to do this song? She had already had hits with some of your songs.
Well, she was like our star vehicle, you know. I mean, we had been recording Dionne and producing her, kind of trying to tailor-make songs that would fit her, and she was an extraordinary vocalist and a great vehicle for what we would write. And the more that we would write for Dionne, the more we would see where we could go with her, the challenges that we could do.
Dionne is a great musician.
Yeah.
Has a great feel for the songs we wrote.
And also how, you know, by having that kind of mobility, I mean, you take a song like Promises, Promises, in somebody else's hands, it could sound maybe labored or under duress being sung. Dionne just kind of floated through it, like effortlessly. And that was one of the things that she had.
She's incredible. Let's hear her recording of Promises, Promises.
I'm up through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. If I shout, remember, I feel free. Now I can look at myself and be proud. I'm laughing out loud. Oh, promises, promises, this is
Let's talk about the other really big hit from the show, I'll Never Fall in Love Again. There's a great story behind the song, so whichever one of you wants to start telling it, go ahead.
Well, when Bert was hospitalized with pneumonia,
it was like maybe 3 days after we opened in Boston,
too.
And we had good reviews in Boston.
Yeah.
We thought we had a hit.
We thought we had a hit, but there was one spot in the show. We had a song called Wouldn't That Be a Stroke of Luck, or something similar to that.
Yeah.
And
that's a good title, Hal.
Yeah. But we threw it out. That song didn't work. Everybody liked the song, but the audience didn't like the song. And while Bert was in the hospital, I started writing lyrics for that song. You know, the famous lines, what do you get when you kiss a girl? You get enough germs to catch pneumonia after you do. She'll never phone you. I don't recall thinking that Bert was in the hospital and had pneumonia, but obviously there was some subconscious thing about it because that's what I wrote.
So
and we wrote it really quickly.
I mean, I gave you a lot of the lyric. I think we wrote it in one day.
The day I got out of the hospital.
The day you got out of the hospital. We played it for Neil and David Merrick. They wanted it in the show the next day. It stopped the show. Like a Hollywood movie, it just stopped the show.
As it did the other night when the opening of the revival. Yeah.
So, Burt Bacharach, you must have been feeling pretty lousy when you wrote the song if you'd just gotten out of the hospital from pneumonia.
Yeah, I felt there's no way to recover from pneumonia is to then write the song and then start standing in the back of the house, meaning in the back of the theater in Boston for the rest of the run, and then going on to Washington and doing the same and being in a sweat and thinking you had the pneumonia back and getting frustrated with the conductor that we had, the tempos and... You know, I'm kind of a control freak, so what was my choice? Go and take the place of the conductor and spend the next 3 years of my life in the pit, in the Broadway pit, conducting. But it's not the way to get over pneumonia.
I bet it's not. But I can understand your frustration. I mean, your songs are so tricky and require, I think, a real sense of precision to really get all the twists and turns in the rhythm. And in the orchestrations, and you must
and
have really
tempos.
And the tempos, and you must have really wanted to be there conducting.
Well, yes, but that is not the answer because then you put the rest of your life and your career on a hold.
Right. You know? Right. Okay, so we have to hear the song now. So this is "I'll Never Fall in Love Again," or, aka the pneumonia song, and why don't we hear Dionne Warwick singing it? Never Fall in Love Again, one of the hit songs from the Broadway show Promises, Promises, which is now being revived on Broadway. My guests are the song's composers, the famous songwriting team of Burt Bacharach and Hal David. So, you know, we were talking before about time signature changes, and there aren't a lot of them in I'll Never Fall in Love Again, but their song, I think, is really significant. It switches from 4-4 time to 2-4 time on the
right.
I'll Never Fall in Love Again, just like one note, I'll. Never Fall in Love Again.
Yeah. Very good observation.
So what does it do to change just for that one note from to the all?
It certainly makes it fresher for me. And it's a nice little turn. And it always surprised me with one of the first records we got on it, Ella Fitzgerald.
Great record.
Except she...
She didn't do it that.
She didn't
squared
do
it.
I'll never fall in love again.
And that bothers you?
But that record was on its way to being a hit. And then Dionne's came out, and of course,
yeah,
Dionne just swamped her.
It's true. But I like it with the 6/4 bar, mm-hmm. or 4/4/2/4, as you say.
Yeah, well, what I like about that is I think it frames the all. Like, everything kind of stops for a second when it's sung that way. But a lot of singers don't do it. A lot of singers just go like, I'll never fall in love again. You know, they don't emphasize. They don't give it the full two beats on the aisle. And it always frustrates me.
Well, they go to the most normal way, but an abnormal way can, in its own right, be the right way. And, you know, can be natural. Just like the easier way out would have been to just not change bar lines, not going 4/4/2/4. But, hey, we didn't do it that way. It didn't hurt us.
So fine. What did it mean to you in 1968 to have a Broadway show, to be on Broadway? Was that important to you?
Well, it was important to me. And I think it was the most fun time I had on any project I've done. I don't know if Bert will feel the same way, but...
If I hadn't gotten sick, I would have had a good time. You know, by the time we did the cast album, I was just looking to get to Palm Springs and not touch a piano for a while. So we should have written another one, but should have and would have and could have. We don't count that out.
Were you asked?
You did enough.
I don't know that we were asked. I just know that I had some frustration, too, that came from the actual parameters of writing something for the theater, and that was... there are substitutes in the orchestra. Maybe there are 2-3 subs in a given performance. My music is not so easy to play. And I remember getting a call from David Merrick.
The producer of the show. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, a week and a half into the show. And he called me up and said, I want you to know that there were 5 subs in the band today. It was a Saturday matinee. Five members of the band had subs. The drummer, first trumpet player. These are key people reading the music for the first time. And Richard Rodgers was in the house.
Oh.
And I say, geez, you know what I mean? You just want to kind of go and stick your head in the sand in the desert. Because you want him to hear it at the best.
So I thought we could close with another song. And this is a song that you wrote that you didn't write for Promises, Promises, but it's been interpolated into the new production. And the song is I Say a Little Prayer. And I thought we'd use Aretha Franklin's 1968 recording of it.
Great record.
Yeah. Were you amazed to hear her record this?
It's a better record than the record we made.
We did, yeah. I mean, we did a great record, but she topped it.
Oh, yeah.
Why is this one better?
Well, you'll hear it.
It's more natural. It's just more natural. We're talking... about bar changes, time changes, on the chorus, forever, forever, stay in my heart. And I, you know, that's going 4/4/3/4/4/4/3/4. Then regard the way it was treated by Aretha, because Aretha just makes it seamless, the transition going from one change to another change. You never notice it.
Okay. It's been really an honor to speak with you both. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, good talking
to you. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. And while combing my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you.
Burt Bacharach and Hal David spoke with Terry Gross in April. Their songs are featured in the Broadway revival of Promises, Promises. The show's nominated for 4 Tony Awards. The presentation ceremony is set for Sunday. Set in the Ozarks, the new film Winter's Bone is the story of a teenage girl who embarks on a search for her missing father. Based on the novel by Daniel Woodrell and directed by Deborah Granick, Winter's Bone won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Daniel Woodrell is a novelist who lives in the Missouri Ozarks. He's often grouped with the more literary types on the crime genre spectrum. I've heard the label country noir. His prose is spare, but deeply evocative of hardscrabble places and the near biblical cruelty they engender. Director Deborah Granick has captured that tone in her harshly beautiful adaptation of Woodrell's 2006 novel, Winter's Bone. The setting is inspired by a small town near Woodrell's home in which everyone is kin and so alienated from American culture, it's like a parallel universe. Woodrell keeps his distance from the scariest and most shrouded of its denizens, and so would his 17-year-old heroine, Ree Dolly, even though she's distantly related. But the threat of homelessness compels her into the woods and up those barren hills, past shacks and rusted-out farm equipment, in search of answers about her father. Ree's mother is mentally ill, near catatonic, and Ree takes care of her young brother and sister. Somehow, she's kept them from being broken by their circumstances. Winter's Bone's opening shots are of the boy and girl on a trampoline in a landscape stripped of life, while a woman on the soundtrack sings unaccompanied in Ozark lullaby. Right from the start, Granick and her cinematographer, Michael McDonough, create a lyrical tension between death and life, despair and determination. Then a cop drives up to tell Ree, played by Jennifer Lawrence, that her dad, Jessup, was arrested for cooking crystal meth and that he's now nowhere to be found.
Where you all come into this is, he put this house here and your timber acres up for his bond.
He what now?
Jessup signed over everything. Now, if he doesn't show at trial, see, the way the deal works is, you all gonna lose this place. Got some place to go?
I'll find him.
Girl, I've been looking.
I said I'll find him.
After telling her siblings never to beg, never to ask for what ought to be given, she sets out for their sake to ask for what ought to be given and beg if she has to. And she has to in every charged encounter, beginning with her best friend, played by Lauren Sweetser, and her father's brother, Teardrop, played by a scarily volatile John Hawkes. Teardrop tells her if she goes much farther, she's liable to get, quote, et by hogs or wishing you were. As Ree, Jennifer Lawrence is hauntingly self-contained. She can't afford to show vulnerability, even to herself. Despite winning a big prize at Sundance, Winter's Bone isn't the usual good-for-you indie movie, what critics and industry people used to call snarkily deadbeat regionalism. Beneath its plainness is an odyssey that's mythic in its intensity, that builds to a confrontation, not with the men perhaps responsible for her father's disappearance, but their haggard wives. Their leader, the wife of a powerful man named Thump Milton, is Mirab, and is played by Dale Dickey. It's impossible to take her full measure. Motherliness and murderousness have melted together. You can't spot the line between this woman's free will and her loyalty to her male-driven clan. You could watch her remarkable performance 100 times and never get to the bottom of it.
What is it you want?
I got a real bad need to talk with Thump.
And he ain't got no need to talk to you.
But I need to. I really... really got to, ma'am, please. Some of our blood at least is the same. Ain't that supposed to mean something? Isn't that what is always said?
Ain't you got no men could do this?
No, ma'am, I don't.
All through Winter's Bone are moments in which the characters are so unfathomably mean to Ree that we search their faces for a glimmer of sympathy, kinship, anything human. Some filmmakers would settle for masks of malevolence because that would clinch the case that these clannish Ozark hillfolk were born or else worn down to pure evil. But director Granick doesn't let her actors go dead. There is movement, barely perceptible under the surface. Some vein of compassion, however thin, must be down there, somewhere. Ree's final scene with Marab, a midnight boat ride into the marshes, is what bad dreams are made of. But for all the horror of Winter's Bone, it's the drive toward life that lingers in the mind. It's a miraculous film. It gets blood from a headstone.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.